Welcome to Embargoed, intelligent talk about sanctions, export controls, and all things international trade for trade nerds and normal human beings alike. I'm one of your hosts, Tim O'Toole, and with me today is Melissa Burgess, a new lawyer that has come to Miller & Chevalier, although she's had a long experience in trade. Welcome, Melissa.
Thank you, Tim.
So glad to have you on the podcast. Today, we're going to be talking about, we're going to do a little riff on a common saying, or a saying that's become pretty common recently. Back in, I think it was April of 2022, Deputy Attorney General Lisa Monaco gave a speech and talked about sanctions as the new FCPA. And today we're going to talk about export controls, and our pod is going to have a tagline that if sanctions are the new FCPA, are export controls the new sanctions? And so I think that's going to be the first segment. We'll probably talk about last week's designations in the Russia program on the anniversary, the two-year anniversary of the war in Ukraine. And then we'll finish with some topics that are in the news about export controls. But kind of the headline issue here today is, okay, there's been this focus on sanctions and, you know, graduating from the, you know, the FCPA focus, which has been really the focus of DOJ white-collar prosecutions for many years. Sanctions are taking center stage, but sanctions are evolving too. And so why don't I throw the first question out there to you, Melissa, so you can talk a little bit about how sanctions have evolved really over the course of the Biden administration, starting in 2021, where they kind of tried to take a new look at sanctions and came out with a policy document, and then moving through today and mostly through the Russian program. So with that big question out there, why don't you take over, and then I'll probably pepper you with questions as you speak.
It sounds great. Thank you. So in 2021, Department of the Treasury took a kind of look into its sanctions programs over the last 20 years, give or take. To look at how effective they'd been, how effective it looked like they were going to be, and whether sanctions needed to adapt to change, to meet changing financial conditions, new technology, new threats. You know, some of those threats that were recent and hadn't been around in the 1990s or early 2000s, you know, we had cyber criminals, we had all sorts of new technological innovations, digital currencies, all sorts of new fintech, new payment platforms, new ways to hide cross-border transactions intentionally or accidentally, new adversaries, new allies, and you know, new ways to, for both of them, to reduce their dependency on the US dollar. And what did that mean? Well, Treasury thought, you know what, we need to adapt and modernize. And how do we do that?
Yeah, and sorry to jump in, but it does seem like that was kind of a prompted in part by the fact that sanctions have become so widespread over the course of the last 20 years. I mean, I think sometimes it's been said that the sanctions are the hammer and every foreign policy problem appears to be the nail. So almost every time you read about something in the news on the foreign policy front, sanctions follow closely after. And I think it sounds like the administration decided we need to be a little bit more precise in what we're trying to do with sanctions, since an embargo doesn't work for everything, and sometimes just blocking sanctions don't work for everything.
Yeah, and just illustrating that, you know, in the year 2000, there were barely 900 designated parties under sanctions. That had ballooned to not quite 10,000 by the year 2021, and it's only grown exponentially since then. But you know, the reason it's grown exponentially really ties to this review and the recommendations coming out of it, which before, you know, if a country was an adversary, was a terrible bad actor, we had comprehensive sanctions. It was just full stop or full stop with only the most minimal carve outs imaginable, which meant you didn't have lots of numbers on designation lists. Russia changed that. But it was it Russia or was it this policy plus Russia? I think probably the latter. So coming out of this review, Treasury decided, you know, we have to have a structured framework that's linking sanctions to a clear policy objective. We can't just say something bad's happening that we don't like, we have to impose sanctions. We need to have clear policy objectives. Thus, we see with Russia, we have, you know, restrictions on specific to certain sectors because we're trying to impose economic harm or limit the activity of those sectors, whether it's military industrial, whether it's technological, whether it's something else. Then we also, Treasury decided, well, these also need to be the right tool for the circumstances. Maybe there are circumstances where traditional economic sanctions, they help, but maybe they aren't the only tool or the best tool. And we've definitely seen that with Russia, Ukraine. And the kind of third big recommendation out of this is that these sanctions need to be easily understood, enforceable, and where possible, reversible. Easily understood, jury might still be out on that one. Easily enforceable, well, I think almost everyone's pretty aware of sanctions enforcement, even before the new FCPA statement. And reversible, well, it's probably too early in the game to see much of that, but definitely the way some of these are tailored, they could be, should Treasury, should the government choose to do so. Another aspect of this is that one of the things that makes sanctions effective is having multilateral coordination. Again, Russia has seen this all over the place. I mean, Switzerland is issuing sanctions, for goodness sake.
Yeah, just a pause on that one. I mean, the level, you know, we've talked about this a number of times on the podcast in the last few years, and the level of multilateral coordination in the Russia sanctions is extremely impressive, and we point to various measures that OFAC and the administration seem to have taken in order to encourage multilateral coordination. And Laura and I talked about on the last podcast, one of those being secondary sanctions, which at the beginning of the Russia program or the main Russia program under 14024, in 2022, the administration was very careful to continue to say there are no secondary sanctions in connection with this program. And there were lots of different rules that were set up so that every country would stay in their lane. And I think the incentive was to, or the goal was to incentivize countries to have their own sanctions and enforce them and not essentially rely on the U.S. And the result has been, I think, an extraordinary level of multilateral coordination. We'll see how long that lasts, particularly in light of some of the foreign policy disputes now about funding Ukraine, but so far, you know, that is completely lined up with the 2021 policy in a way that I've never seen before.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, that multilateral approach has not remained limited to quote unquote pure sanctions either, as we'll see in a little bit. And so one of the last, or perhaps the last major point that came out of that 2021 review was calibrated sanctions. You know, they aren't supposed to just broadly block everybody within a certain country all the time. Maybe that's not the right measure either for the goal or for the people who are going to have to comply with it, the U.S. persons who have to comply with it. So again, that's one of the reasons. Even though there are a lot of sanctions affecting Russia, we haven't seen actual comprehensive sanctions on Russia.
Yeah, and I think on that one, it really has been interesting to watch how the U.S. has tried to impose sanctions in a way that is very different from the Iran program, certainly very different from the Cuba program. And you know, the jury, I guess, is still out on the humanitarian impact because Russia is a bigger country. It has access to its own food supplies. Whether or not the sanctions have, you know, caused the sorts of humanitarian harms that they can cause with respect to smaller countries and particularly ones that don't have their own kind of internal network of humanitarian resources is hard to say. But these are much more targeted than most sanctions are. There's no question about that. And so, you know, whether it's lined up with, you know, the administration's three-pronged approach to new sanctions. I think the jury is still out, but it is definitely a targeted regime as opposed to the, you know, we're just going to prohibit all exports and all exports of services and all transactions coming in or out of the particular sanctioned country, like a full-on embargo. It's not that. It's getting close, but it's
yeah. Yes, you'd be forgiven for not being able to keep track of that fact. And that's, you know, again, it's been targeted, but that target has gotten broader and broader.
It's grown and grown.
We just have that many more targets that we've set up.
Well, and we've also adopted a secondary sanctions regime in the last 3 or 4 months as well. So that has been done, I think, with multilateral coordination. I don't think that certainly the European allies don't seem as upset by the secondary sanctions imposed against Russia as they were with respect to the secondary sanctions imposed against Iran and in some sense against Cuba, where, you know, you saw European blocking statutes. I haven't heard any talk of a European attempt to block our secondary sanctions against Russia. So even there's been multilateral coordination, but it's fraying a little bit. I mean, this program is growing. Sometimes it's not totally clear to me that the new sanctions are tailored to a particular policy. We'll talk in the next segment about some of the new sanctions that have come out. That said, I think, you know, those sanctions, as we'll talk about, target diversion, and diversion has been a big enforcement issue, and those sanctions target various practices and policies that I think you could mostly articulate, even though maybe not always articulate. So with that, I mean, so why don't we talk a little bit about the joinder of export controls and sanctions at the hip. But before we do, I just have one observation about kind of this new modernized approach to sanctions. And it weirdly kind of reminded me of this monologue that George Carlin does, where he talks about baseball and football, and baseball is green fields and getting an inning out on the diamond, and football is, you know, penalties and roughing the pet, like, and in some ways, like, sanctions are the football, right? Sanctions are just this big blunderbuss instrument that you come in and you just slam somebody with, whereas export controls are, you know, they're targeted and they're moderated, and everybody gets together at the Wassenaar arrangement meetings and they talk about what sanctions we're going to impose or what export controls we're going to impose, and they look at new technologies and study new technologies and come up with ways to have export controls with new technologies. And so sanctions, I think, as they modernize, are becoming a little more like export controls. And so why don't you talk about how, in fact, sometimes sanctions now are becoming export controls?
Yep. Well, you know, on that comprehensive sanctions front, you know, we haven't seen that. But a kind of standard piece of when we don't go there is an arms embargo. Well, that was kind of the lowest hanging fruit here. Obviously, we're going to have an arms embargo. And that, a lot of that predated even the invasion. We already had a bunch of those restrictions. But what more can we do? Well, for BIS in particular, you know, between Russia and China over the years leading up to 2022, you know, we'd had this escalation of, we now have military end users restrictions like never before. Well, that obviously is more low-hanging fruit that we can slap on top of an arms embargo, where, you know, it's not just about the rockets and the missiles and the tanks. It's about all sorts of other related services and very specific end users. On top of that, with the multilateral coordination and the kind of awkwardness of Russia being a member of Wassenaar, we have, you know, a new global export control coalition where it's, well, we, the U.S., we want to take these steps. Some of them affect things that we've already all collectively agreed on we want to control. So we know it would be easy for us to collectively stop the flow of those items into Russia or Belarus. But, you know, that's not enough, because now we need to, you know, we're looking at sector-specific restrictions, you know, oil and gas equipment, exploration equipment, luxury goods, for goodness sake. Since when, do we put export controls on just purely expensive, fancy goods? But
It
that
really
all
is.
leads.
So where you're going is starting to make me think that sanctions aren't becoming more like export controls. Export controls are becoming more like sanctions. I don't know. That's starting to be what it sounds like.
It's definitely getting, those lines are very, very blurry.
Well, and
They do still
Vossenar,
exist, but
they're
they're
trying to
very
make
blurry.
Vossenar go away, right? I mean, the Global Export Control Coalition. I mean, Vossenar has been around since, I think, the end of World War II, at least, and has been
Yeah,
kind of a
various iterations.
working group that has come up with kind of a uniform set of export controls for the world that included Russia, but all sorts of other countries besides Russia. And we're moving away from that. Is that a is that more sanctions-like or export control-like? I don't know. It sounds like sanctions to me.
It's definitely a good question. Well, and it's, the US has always had unilateral controls, in many ways, far more of those than any other Vossenar state. And this new GECC, as the shorthand it goes, gives the US a chance to maybe poke and prod a little more about some of those things that we've controlled unilaterally, but other countries haven't, and give us, a bit more ease in making sure those controls are actually effective, because now some of these other countries, maybe willingly, maybe a little more because the US is pushing them, are agreeing to these same restrictions and enforcing these same restrictions.
So
And it's
not the 900 series comes to the world, right? So the anti-terrorism controlled items that are unique to the US, you couldn't
But
get them
not
through
just
Vossenar,
that.
right? Right.
And it's not just that. It's now we have now export controls are suddenly running into imports in ways they didn't before,
Oh,
because
yeah.
now we're looking at the harmonized tariff schedule.
Yes, I was hopeful that I would be able to finish my career without ever really knowing that the harmonized tariff schedule existed. And now you've got to do
You
it to be a
can't.
sanctions lawyer. You got to do it to be an export controls lawyer. It's depressing.
But I think one of the ways where the lines between sanctions and export controls are blurring the most, perhaps, is used to be, and this is very loosely speaking, but it used to be you could look at an OFAC list, your person's not there. There's no comprehensive sanction or something like that involved. You knew you were good to go. But now the entity list is growing by leaps and bounds. I tried to run a quick comparison of the entity list, early 2022 versus now, and it crashed. It couldn't load
Yeah, I mean, I and so
it.
it's funny. I mean, and the entity list has just grown exponentially because it's something that nobody really heard about until ZTE went on the entity list, and people are like, "What's that? Wow, they seem to not like it." But even the SDN list, I think, has grown
Oh,
just
exponentially.
in a huge way since the start of the Russia war. I think I mentioned to this to you offline, but I ran a search yesterday, just trying to figure out how many designations there were under the 14024, the Russian harmful foreign activities sanctions, and the basically it crashed. It said there's too many results, we can't tell you. If you run a search on OFAC's search tool for any other program, you'll just get a list of everybody who's sanctioned under that program, but you can't, they broke their machine. They broke the internet with this new designations. And like you said, the entity list is far beyond that, and in part because it's not totally clear to me what the criteria are for really being on the entity list. Like you get there because you do things that the US doesn't like from a foreign policy perspective, but it's in many ways much broader than what gets you on the SDN list.
Well, it could be arranged because it could be, involvement in alleged or suspected retransfers without a license. It could be some other foreign policy or national security threat perceived by BIS or state or some other party. It could be human rights violations. There are a host of reasons you can get on the entity list. Well, and more recently, including if commerce can't verify your bona fides, you might end up on the entity list till they can run their end use checks and their verification checks on you. So It's definitely for foreign entities. It's also a new risk that they probably never had to consider before, just because, you know, suddenly they're in crosshairs in ways that aren't part of their operating
procedures.
Well, and it
creates all sorts of confusion because, you know, it's the SDN list and the restrictions on that are relatively complicated. I mean, we're thankful for that. People ask us lots of questions on that, and we answer them, and sometimes we get paid to answer them. But with a new list and a very, very different set of restrictions, it becomes really hard for non-US parties in particular to figure out what a hit on these lists mean. And it used to be that if you got a hit for the SDN list, that's really all you had to worry about. But
yep, there's your answer.
The entity list, yeah. The entity list has serious restrictions. The unverified list also has some restrictions. And then, you know, OFAC imposes these menu sanctions. And so it used to be like you got a hit, you knew what it meant. Mm-hmm. Now it's okay, well, what list? And, you know, when was the listing? And what country are we talking about? I mean, it does get much more complicated.
Yep. To put it mildly. And then, if we can maybe do some business with them, depending what our business is, if they're just on the entity list, but how much of that business? And then we suddenly run into kind of the new player in the export control picture of banks are suddenly much more involved in, is it an export as opposed to, are they a designated party or is it a designated bank on the receiving end or sending?
Well, and a question that I got in the last week or so made me think again about how much this line is blurring, because, you know, when you consider the growth in the entity list, but then the very recent growth in the use of General Prohibition 10 by the Commerce Department, and particularly in connection with the Russia program. And for those of you who are not full-time export control nerds, General Prohibition 10 is basically the rule under the EAR, which has been there forever, but has been pretty obscure until recently, that says once you know that a violation took place, here are 27 things that you cannot do in connection with that violation. And I think for the most part, the entity list restrictions were viewed until this growth of General Prohibition 10 as not something that really applied all that much to the banks, right? I mean, they shouldn't finance a transaction that violates the entity list, but it was really more of a, if you export a good in violation of entity list restrictions to some party that's on the entity list and it's the good is subject to the EAR, then you, the exporter, have problems. But it really didn't go back to the bank, not necessarily. But with the use of General Prohibition 10, if the bank finances that transaction, they're certainly, if they know it, they're potentially on the hook under General Prohibition 10. And so the financing conditions are very similar to what they would be if the entity list entity was an SDN. And so even though the entity listing itself doesn't restrict financing, given the rise in the use of General Prohibition 10, it may well be hard to have financial transactions with an entity list entity, certainly if it involves some sort of improper shipment.
Yeah. And, you know, we're seeing that kind of growth of financing the financial world and the exporting world in many other ways that, you know, they're all running into each other. I mean, a very new development out of all of this is, you know, BIS and FinCEN issuing joint alerts.
And, wait, they didn't even know where each other lived until recently, and now they're working together.
Yeah, you know, it wasn't surprising when FinCEN and OFAC did things together. They were
both
kind
in the Treasury,
of related,
right?
But
yeah, so that has been very interesting, and you know, it's been expressed. So, you know, the new secondary sanctions that were imposed in December expressly kind of went down this road. They said, you know, foreign financial institutions that finance transactions of a certain type, basically those items that we think are going to the Russian military, can themselves be sanctioned, which basically gives the financial institutions a much greater role in digging down into the, not just who are the parties to this transaction, but what does it involve, right? Because an entity list compliance is not like, OFAC compliance. Like if you are trying to comply with entity list restrictions, you don't need just to screen the parties. You then need to figure out, well, what's the transaction involved? If it doesn't involve an item subject to the EAR, or at least, and you know, not all listings are the same even there, or an item subject to the EAR that is off limits without a license to the entity list entity, then like the financing should be fine. So you need to know exactly what's being shipped and what its ECCN is, or whether it's EAR 99 once you find the entity list hit. Same way for these new secondary sanctions. Like the banks need to know, okay, not just who are the parties, but what is the transaction involved before they can say this transaction is a problem. And honestly, I do think that what the end result of that will likely be, and with both entity list entities and then kind of these Russia transactions, is just more banks saying it's not worth it, right? You can either bulk up your compliance so that you have a bunch of export control specialists, or you can say, yeah, you know what? It's just too hard to sell to Russia because there is this secondary sanctions risk, or to finance Russia transactions. So foreign financial institutions might say it's not worth it. In the same way with entity list entities, like, yes, there are lots of things that US persons can do lawfully with entity list entities, but figuring out whether or not this transaction is one of them is really hard. And so banks might just say, yeah, we're not going to deal with it, even though we could. So I think it's an interesting development because it makes compliance charges, you know, challenges much harder. And one way you could deal with those is to hire more export control experts. And we've talked on at least one of the podcasts about that possibility. I think banks are staffing up in that way. But on the other hand, the other way to deal with it is basically just de-risking and say, okay, entity list entities, too risky, no more banking. Russia, too risky, no more banking. And a lot of, you know, to be fair, I think a lot of foreign financial institutions had already made that call with respect to Russia, because, and certainly US financial institutions have. But it's interesting as these two things converge to see which way it's going to go. You know, will export controls become more like sanctions, or will sanctions become more like export controls? And in the same way, kind of, will banks in particular, but companies generally, bulk up their export controls compliance, or will they just de-risk and say, yeah, anytime it's too hard, we're just going to say no?
Well, and the entity list aspect isn't a Russia specific issue, even if Russia's a major portion of it. So I think that's a little harder question for some financial institutions, at least, is, well, you know, there are a lot of entity list entries in China and increasingly in other countries. So, you know, even if we have a kind of de-risk policy for Russia, we probably can't just stick our head in the sand and say we won't do it. We've got to actually, you know, come up with something.
No, that's a great point. I mean, it really is, you know, with Russia, you can just kind of look at it and say there's so much trouble with dealing with the Russian financial system because it's so heavily sanctioned. But China is, it's just such a big economy and so important to the United States that it's really would be a lot harder to just de-risk on China. And you're right. I mean, the entity list has been used, if anything, more extensively as a policy tool with respect to China than it has with Russia. So, well, anything else about this first topic about export controls being the new sanctions that you wanted to?
Well, you know, I think getting back to the analogy of, you know, sanctions as the new FCPA and the morph of it, you know, part of the Deputy Attorney General's rationale for using that analogy was, okay, sanctions are now applicable to expanding number of industries. You know, it's not just about the U.S., it's all multilateral, and big incentivization for voluntary disclosures. So coming back to export controls, I think that's exactly what we've seen. It's, you know, applicable to an expanding number of industries, you know, banks, all sorts of license requirements for EAR 99 items to Russia that, you know, we haven't really seen before. Definite yes to multilateral enforcement, both with the new Global Export Controls Coalition, task forces, you name it. And, you know, another big part of this has been BIS in particular, really ramping up its enforcement program. You know, new voluntary disclosure policies, you know, a new fast track process, but also, you know, some new penalties there in terms of, if you want a good settlement, you're going to have to admit to that violation. And oh, by the way, if you intentionally don't disclose, you choose not to, well, that voluntary was maybe a little voluntold, and we're gonna probably hold that against you.
Yeah, that's the one that I still am having a hard time wrapping my mind around because it's very un-American, right? I mean, in America, you don't have an obligation to go turn yourself into the police for the most part. I mean, there's this one part of 126.1 in the ITAR that does make that happen, or at least violations of the 126.1 country arms embargo are mandatory disclosures. But other than that, there's really no area where, voluntary disclosures are mandatory, or where there's any obligation to disclose. Now you get leniency, so it is a fine line, right? You get leniency if you disclose, and you get treated in the normal way if you don't, right? If they don't, if you don't, and so the incentive was to disclose. But now that change has become a big flip. That is, it has become, if you don't disclose, we will view that as an aggravating circumstance, i.e., we will punish you. And punishing people for not speaking, and it is potentially, we'll see how it's applied. That's all I'll have to say on that. I mean, I think because it is such a fine line, we'll see if it's nuanced in its application, because it is a very sensitive area in U.S. law, and it does potentially trample on some things that the courts wouldn't like if they ever have to see one of these cases. All right. So with that, why don't we talk about 1 week ago today? We're going to talk a little more about Russia. 1 week ago today, we're recording on March 1st. So February 23rd was basically the 2 year anniversary of the Ukraine invasion. I think it might have been a day later, but because the 23rd was Friday, OFAC and BIS decided that they'd rather come out with a new package of sanctions on a Friday rather than a Saturday, which makes some sense. Why don't you talk a little bit, Melissa, about kind of the, give us the stats on what happened last Friday.
Well, continuing that close relationship between export controls and sanctions these days, OFAC had its announcement, Commerce did too. OFAC designated approximately 300 new parties, bringing the to-date total for Russia to over 4,000. Again, just quick comparison point. Remember that 2000, the year 2000 number for total designations was only 920-ish. So
Wow.
300 in one day is a massive change from, granted, almost a quarter of a century ago. But in conjunction with that, with OFAC's numbers, State had a bunch of designations and some new visa restrictions, and Commerce had yet another 90 companies added to the entity list, some of them, multiple locations across multiple countries. Targets of all of these designations are not, for the most part, not really surprising. It's kind of a continuation of the same. So continuing to target the military industrial base, because apparently there were some that we hadn't specifically targeted yet. Targeting some of the workarounds that Russian enterprise has come up with as a result of the sanctions. Their substitute card payment system. What OFAC and State are terming as like circumvention and backfill efforts. So, maybe they can't get the parts for certain things, so let's target the additive manufacturing industry and other, machine tool providers.
Right. And that may, the additive manufacturing, is I think what Commerce is saying with that is, or what OFAC is saying with that as well, because some of these were designations. Oh, if you, the Russian economy has decided, since we can't import it, we'll make it. And so additive manufacturing tools sometimes allow countries and companies and people to make things that they couldn't otherwise get, and so you just need the raw materials. And so that was interesting to me to see that as a U.S. sanctions target. I'm not sure that we've really seen that much before.
Now, well, additive manufacturing is still new enough. I mean, it's getting pretty established, but it's still new enough that prior programs, prior events that are roughly similar, it wouldn't have been a feature.
Yep. But kind of the tools to make stuff as opposed to the stuff itself.
You know, a few other interesting points about these designations is kind of the spread of, you know, maybe where some of these third parties are that are getting caught up. You know, we've seen China, I believe we've seen India before, Germany, you know, some of those border countries, they tend to appear fairly frequently. But, you know, we're starting to see some of the, like Serbia and South Korea even got caught on the South Korean entities on the entity list. So it's definitely a wide net that is being cast for
entities. Very interesting. So it was not surprising. We kind of knew that there was going to be a big package coming on the 23rd. The targets were mostly unsurprising. I will say the one thing that surprised me from these is what was not among the designations, or at least not heavily represented among the designations. And that was in light of the secondary sanctions that were out there against foreign financial institutions, I thought we would see more designations, or at least some serious number of designations under those secondary sanctions. And we didn't really see that. And I've been trying to figure out, getting ready for this podcast and just generally, why that was. And I suspect that with financial institutions, sometimes warnings will work, and often warnings are tried. And so I think there was a lot of fear definitely in that community that sanctions were coming to particular countries in connection with this round of sanctions. And I think they may not have come in part because warnings were issued and OFAC is seeing how those warnings work before trying to impose sanctions, particularly on banks in countries that are friendly to or have been traditionally friendly to the U.S. I think the hope is that you can kind of get more compliance through talking and through persuading and through, you know, talking very seriously, and some would call it threatening, some would call it warning. So you can look at it either way, but I think that's the sort of thing that I suspect went on and why we didn't see these sanctions this time around. And if those warnings do not work, we may see them next time around.
And it's a little early still in the secondary sanctions program. Obviously, there's 2 years worth of transactions kind of backed up that could be pried into, but, you know, it's really only a few months since that came out, and it does take a little research to connect all those dots if you're trying to use that as the basis for a designation.
Yep. All right. Well, why don't we talk a little bit about the news before signing off? One thing that I saw in the news this week was that I think there was an SEC disclosure that was reported on in connection with Applied Materials, you know, big U.S. chip maker. The allegation was that it is apparently, then the subpoenas relate to potential shipments of controlled chips to China, but by way of a South Korean subsidiary. Do you want to talk a little bit about those subpoenas and any comments you might have on them?
So this is a continuation, not the first of related subpoenas, but I think it really shows that, you know, the BIS move on semiconductor manufacturing in China is, you know, it's very much an ongoing, ever-present, and going to be very, very thoroughly enforced area. You know, so the target supplies or makes semiconductor fabricating equipment. So obviously, one of the biggest things China needs is this equipment, and that's been, you know, a big part of the semiconductor restrictions in the EAR, is not just, you know, how to manufacture the semiconductors, but the equipment necessary for, and the whole, you know, foreign direct product rules that play into that, and, you know, product of a plant that involves U.S. equipment. So there's, you know, there's a lot of, you know, a tangled web to sort through when complying with all of that. But, you know, it's very expensive equipment. And so it's kind of a prime target for BIS to look at from an enforcement perspective of if this equipment is still making it to China. How's it getting there? Why is it getting there?
Yeah, I mean, it's really, I guess it's the first big enforcement action we're seeing arising out of the developments, I think, in October of 2022 with respect to all of the restrictions that went on supercomputers and superchips, but then also manufacturing in the chip industry in China itself and these fab facilities that were put on not only heightened export controls, but there were even sanction-like U.S. person restrictions with respect to working in Chinese fab facilities. So it is another instance of the blurring of export controls and sanctions, because generally sanctions are not, or export controls are not targeting U.S. person behavior, but that was one instance where they did, and this is an investigation arising out of at least those developments, as best we can tell from the public record. It should be very clear here, we're just talking about what we read in the papers. There's no confidential information that we have here. We're just observers. So with that, why don't we talk about what happened yesterday? And is it yesterday? It might have been 2 days ago, but in connection with the Commerce Department's announcement that it would be starting to look at connected vehicles, that is, cars that are connected to the internet. Now, I'm saying that is the definition, but one of the questions that Commerce has posed is, what are connected vehicles? It's going to do a proposed rulemaking and is trying to think about the implications. And again, the supply chain executive order is the genesis of this, the one that President Trump issued back in 2019, where we're essentially allowing the regulatory agencies or directing them to take a look at the supply chain and how it can present national security issues. This announcement of proposed rulemaking is targeting connected vehicles and saying we need to think about how connected vehicles in foreign adversary countries and mostly targeting China might pose national security threats. And so you get this kind of dystopian view of like cars being connected to the internet, and then all of a sudden whoever made those cars back in one of these foreign adversary countries just takes over the controls and starts driving the cars in various ways. I think there's also a concern that it's going to take out personal data that the connected vehicles collect about U.S. users. And so why don't you talk a little bit about the developments of this week with respect to connected vehicles?
Yeah. Yeah, so Commerce's involvement here really comes under Executive Order 13873, which is part of the Information and Communications Technology and Services. So ICTS, we had an executive order a few years ago saying maybe we need to evaluate some of these ICTS transactions from a national security perspective. And this is over and above and separate from CFIUS. And these transactions are potentially subject to review when they include the acquisition, importation, transfer, installation, dealing in, or use of ICTS by any person or involving any property subject to U.S. jurisdiction. So kind of what's the link between that and connected vehicles? It's, well, a lot of the vehicles themselves, but primarily, you know, essential elements, critical elements, parts, software, you name it, for these vehicles has, or potentially Commerce thinks it probably has, a link to China and other foreign countries of concern. So Commerce really wants to get wrap its hands around, well, what is a connected vehicle in the first place? You know, it's more than an EV, probably. It's more than, it's not just an autonomous vehicle. It probably has a few different shapes and forms. And then what is the supply chain for connected vehicles? You know, where do things come from? What are the failure points, the pressure points in that supply chain? Are they, you know, is it sole sources in China, very specific, you know, raw materials or components, you name it. And then, you know, what are the risks? You know, we can sit here and imagine, you know, someone remotely taking over your car and driving it places you had no intention of going, but a lot of what commerce is looking at is more that, the communications aspect of it, of, there are all these wireless connection points in cars these days, especially these, higher tech cars. And, they collect data, or some of them collect data about all sorts of things, the environment around them, driving patterns, what they're sensing as they go down the road, when they're being driven, what the weather's like. And then obviously with all these wireless connection points, then you're worrying about cybersecurity for that data. And so commerce wonders, well, what are the standards that are currently in place for any of that? What are the best practices? And then assuming commerce determines, well, there definitely are risks here that, and we will have to, review these transactions from an ICTS standpoint. How will we do that? How will we determine when one is a risk, when one isn't, and when one can be mitigated and when it can't? So what would be appropriate mitigation measures for any of these types of transactions? So go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, so it's going to be interesting for them to think about that. I have to say, when I first heard about this, I thought, well, how many Chinese cars are there? And, not a lot of North Korean cars. So what is the big risk here? Is this worth it? But then I remembered that this is a supply chain executive order, which is really looking at these sorts of information technology, but where's the supply chain? And so if you're talking about the parts, and the parts that could be used either to collect personal data, or maybe you just need one critical part of the car that is able to be compromised, and then someone outside the U.S. could take control over the car if they needed to in particular circumstances. That does get a little bit more scary and a little bit more realistic, because my guess is that when you look at the supply chain for anything that's made in the United States, you're still going to find a lot of parts that are made overseas, and particularly a lot of parts that are made in China.
Yeah, and it's definitely, this isn't commerce, all that worried about traditional drivetrains or something. This is very much about, the computer aspects of it that cars haven't had in, decades, previous decades, that
it
are
is
now just
sad.
Such a part of it, the car.
It is really sad, though, because, I have a car that is connected to the internet, or at least I can, manipulate some things, like I can turn the heat on from my phone and do other things like that. And I've thought that is so cool. And then you think, okay, well, yeah, it's cool, but that also creates all sorts of vulnerabilities that didn't exist before, when basically if your car was parked out in front of your house, the only people that you had to worry about were people who were trying to break into it, or some, or whether or not somebody was going to hit it when they come down the street. But you don't have to worry that somebody sitting overseas is going to be able to start doing things with your car that you don't want to have happen.
Yep. We're a bit past just, can they hack in and unlock your doors from their computer?
Exactly.
Can they hack the whole car?
Exactly. And drive it somewhere you don't want it to go, or pull all sorts of data out of your car that you don't want them to have.
Yep. Thriller and horror movies in the making.
Exactly. Well, with that, it's been good talking. Anything else you want to talk about going forward? You got any speaking things coming up? What do you want to talk about before we sign off?
No, but I think we have to remind everybody of an announcement from our last episode coming up later this month. If you want to take it away.
Sure. Well, so we will be having festivities in connection with Update on our lovely balcony here in Washington, D.C. to celebrate the Update Festival, the Update Conference that BIS puts on every year. And it's going to be on the Tuesday of Update, which I think is March 28th, if I get it wrong.
26th.
It's the 26th. See, I knew I would get it wrong. So if and anybody who is in town and wants to go is welcome. You do need to RSVP. You can't just, this is classy, so you have to tell us that you're coming before you just show up off the street. But if you do want to go, just email Melissa or me, or email Miller and Chevalier, and let us know that you're interested in coming to the event. We're sponsoring it with Jacobson, Burton and Kelly and Beth Pride, so very good co-sponsors of this event, and it should be very fun and hopefully a good opportunity to have some intelligent talk about export sanctions and all things international trade. probably a lot of trade nerds there, if I had to guess.
Just maybe.
So with that, I will let folks know. I don't know if this is going to come out before then, but I'll be in Switzerland next week moderating a panel that is called Are Sanctions the New FCPA? So that is a common theme. And we'll be talking a little bit about some of the topics that you and I talked about here. So next week, the week of March 4th in Switzerland, in Zurich. But otherwise, see you on the next podcast. Thanks a lot for being on, Melissa.
Yep.
And thanks a lot for listening. Stay sanctions free, everyone.
Produced by Heartcast Media.